Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities with Lisa Zimmer. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today we have a wonderful, informative guest, author and professor Dawn Skorzewski. I'm so sorry, Dawn. I really had this down pat just before I had to say it. We are going to talk about An Accident of Hope, which is the therapy tapes of Anne Sexton. And without further ado, I'll let Dawn say her name correctly. Dawn, thank you so much for being my guest today. Can you please say
your
whole
name?
Thank you,
Lisa. Yes, so my name is Dawn Skorzewski. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're very welcome.
I'm excited to talk to you about this topic. I think other people might be too, so it'll be fun.
This is a great, insightful book in regard to the inner dynamics of the mind. I really found let's start with telling our audience, who is Anne Sexton and how was she an inspiration for you?
Well, Anne Sexton was an American poet. She was born in 1928, so she came of age as a poet in the late 50s, early 60s. And she has some very special characteristics that are a bit unusual for a poet. For one thing, she started her life in Newton, Massachusetts, and with in the home of a very wealthy family. And she was the youngest of three sisters, and her parents didn't spend a lot of time thinking about their daughters' careers or successful lives in the future. Her parents were much more oriented around their own social lives and activities, and they basically thought their daughters should look good and become homemakers. And mm-hmm. So that's what the three daughters did. So Anne Sexton grew up to become a housewife, but she didn't like it too much. And after the birth of her first child, she had almost a complete mental breakdown, which was in part caused by a postpartum depression that she was experiencing. And at that time, she sought therapy, and she actually ended up in Westwood Lodge, a mental hospital, and she started working with this guy, Martin Oren, who was a psychiatric resident at the time, around her same age. She ended up seeing him for the next 8 years, and when she started working with Oren, Sexton told him, he said, you know, we got to find something for you to do that makes you feel like a meaningful contributor to society. And she said, well, the only thing I can think of is prostitution. I could do that, make men feel sexually powerful. And he said, well, how about writing? What if you wrote about your experiences for others who have the same pains and traumas that you do? And she said, well, I'll try that. So she started writing poetry. She wrote him about 100 poems in the next 6 months. And within 3 years, she was a published American woman poet. And within, let's see, 6 more years, she had won the Pulitzer Prize. So it's a pretty impressive rise to fame.
Right.
It's a longer story than the one that I'm telling, but the basics of it, Anne Sexton wrote poems about women's lives and women's experiences of mental illness, especially, and also women's bodies and childhood experiences, things that people weren't talking about yet in poetry or in literature very much, but especially in poetry. So she was one of the first, what they call, confessional poets. And you might recognize Sylvia Plath as one of the others.
Right.
Sexton is sort of in the same world as Sylvia Plath. They actually went together to the not knowing each other, but they met at the Radcliffe Institute, which is here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they studied poetry, and they wrote poetry together, and actually had drinks at the Ritz together. So Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath were pretty good friends. You know, Sylvia Plath did kill herself in 1963, and Anne Sexton killed herself in 1974, which was much later, but she finally gave in to her struggles with her mental illness, and that's what sort of killed her in the end.
Now,
there are more
in
other factors, but
In regard to the postpartum depression that she went through,
yeah.
Was it diagnosed then? Because I know
yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot of awareness to mental illness at that time.
Right.
So did they diagnose it as postpartum?
I think they did. I think they did know that it was related to the birth of a child because her doctor prescribed vitamins, women's vitamins, basically for her. But I think they didn't know the depths of how postpartum depression could work. You know, ultimately, she suffered from mental illness her whole life, and she would be diagnosed today with what we call bipolar disorder, probably.
Okay.
So it was, she, you know, was precipitated by this postpartum depression, but it wasn't like it was her first experience of being depressed. I think she
right.
had unstable moods her whole life, and she had a pretty difficult childhood. Her parents, as I said, were pretty self-absorbed, and they didn't pay a lot of attention to their daughters and think about their needs, but they also were drinkers, so there's a lot of drinking in the family of alcoholics, and her father could be very abusive when he was drinking, and he would say things, especially to Anne, about her body. Like, he said that she looked like she was going out to get fucked.
Okay.
When she went on a date one night, and he also said that her facial acne was making him ill at the table.
Right.
So he had to leave the table. So he's very abusive, verbally abusive, and sometimes physically abusive to Anne. And there was, she always had the question about whether he actually had sexually abused her when she was a child, that she thought that,
right.
that might have happened, but she couldn't really remember the details. So it was a question in her mind. So there were all these childhood traumas that were contributing to her mental state as well. I don't think we can leave those behind.
Right.
You know, when we talk
right.
about her challenges. But she definitely did have manic episodes and depressive episodes as well.
Now, in regard to her therapist, was this yes, and was his ways of working with her were a little bit cutting edge at the time.
Definitely,
can we
yeah.
talk a little bit about how psychoanalysis came into her therapy and really how society at that time looked at it versus how we look at psychoanalysis today?
Well, you know, when she was first in the mental hospital, one of the things that they were considering is shock treatment. And he really thought that was a bad idea and didn't want her to have shock treatment and said no. So she didn't have shock treatment. But he was an expert in hypnosis. He eventually ended up running a research center at the University of Pennsylvania that was based primarily around memory and how people
okay.
remember. And hypnosis was a part of that. So he was quite interested in hypnotizing her at the beginning to see if that would help her remember things from her past that were holding her back in the present, and also help her deal with it. She had these sort of trances that she would go into, so he wondered if that would facilitate that. She would kind of go like out of consciousness and just, I think today we would call it dissociating. So
okay.
He would see her for longer than the usual 1 hour appointment. You know, he wasn't a psychoanalyst, but he was psychoanalytically trained. That the people that he worked with at Mass Mental were psychoanalysts. So his supervisors were psychoanalysts. But he didn't have her on the couch, for example. She didn't lie on the couch. She sat up and spoke to him. And when you listen to the therapy tapes, which I did, as you know, that's how I wrote this book.
Right.
You hear both of them, but especially Anne, you hear her smoking all through, the cane smoking.
Oh, how interesting.
So it's a very odd thing. Because today, of course, we don't have patients smoking in the therapy session, just not allowed. But that was in different culture, sort of like the Mad Men culture, you know. So
right,
she would stay
right.
on doctor sometimes. Yeah, well, go ahead.
It really took me back to that that visual. Because, you know, in reading the book, it definitely took me back to, like, you know, the 1960s, and
yes.
I was born in the 60s, so, you know, it was an interesting
yes.
kind of, you know, perception that I gained from reading the book. And it really gave me insight into, you know, how the mind works. Here's a very, very intelligent woman, someone who
yes,
definitely,
very.
Yeah, you know, like almost not even valuing how intelligent she was.
Not
and
at all.
Yet
no.
at the same point, such depth and such, you know, the inner workings of the mind are such an incredible, you know, discovery, because there's
yes.
so much that you can layer upon layer to learn from. And,
yes.
you know, just because mental illness comes into the picture with many, many people, it doesn't
yes.
diminish all their
That's
wonderful
right.
traits and qualities.
No. Yeah, and I think, you know, we started talking about her difficulties growing up and, you know, the challenges that she faced and the fact that she started writing therapy in a mental institution, although she had written some therapy when she was in high school. but her mother accused her of plagiarism. And so when that happened, she stopped writing poetry. So she was a poet before she was a patient. And sometimes it's told the other way around. But we started with that aspect of her life. But the fact is, she was an incredibly intelligent woman, and she wrote volumes and volumes of poetry, beautiful poetry, poetry that now is very popular with wide audiences, not just academics, but with, you know, just people. Like, for example, when I was writing my dissertation, my first work on Anne Sexton, I was at Rutgers University, that's where I studied, and I was in this local small library, not library, bookstore, like a used bookstore in New Brunswick. And it wasn't even in the middle of the town, it's kind of on the outskirts. And I was looking for Anne Sexton's poems, and I went over to find them, and there was somebody else there, and he said, oh, I'm so addicted to Anne Sexton. And he was just some guy, I think he drove a truck or something, and she was a poet that he loved. And that's really common, that people people who love Anne Sexton are often not people that we would think of as poetry readers. You know, that it's a very eclectic and somewhat eccentric crowd of people who feel that her poems about, like, for example, childhood experience or about the body or about therapy are really interesting poems, and they go to her for those. And also she has all these fairy tale poems, revised fairy tales in her volume Transformation, where she rewrote poems like Sleeping Beauty for a modern audience. And so people like those too.
Do you feel like people are actually drawn to her because of their mental health or struggling
Definitely,
with mental health
yes.
disease?
I think sometimes people are struggling. Sorry, Lisa, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, do you think the therapist possibly encouraged her writings?
I do think that. I think that they say you might like these poems because they're about the topics that you're talking about. You know, her first volume of poetry starts with a poem to her psychiatrist. It's a beautiful poem. It says, "You, Dr. Martin, go from breakfast to madness." It's a really nice line.
And, it's interesting because they don't really talk about any, was there any transference in regard to emotions in this relationship? Because it became quite an emotionally intimate relationship.
Yeah, I think on both sides. I think that he thought of himself as a kind of father to her, even though he was only a year older. He felt very protective of her. And I think she also looked at him as a kind of father figure. And I think she didn't really allow herself to go there, but she often had crushes on her doctor. So her doctor after Dr. Orne ended up in a sexual relationship with her. He violated therapeutic boundaries, and I think that was one of the things that led to her suicide in the early 70s because she felt so betrayed by that doctor. But Dr. Orne didn't go there. He didn't do that. He had very good boundaries, and I think that he didn't allow himself to get caught up in that kind of erotic transference stuff. He just didn't. He deliberately avoided it. I think it was obvious that it would be a danger because of what she said at the very beginning of the treatment, you know, that she thought she could make men feel sexually powerful. So I think he was trying to avoid her doing that with him because that wouldn't help her. And she did end up having a lot of sexual relationships with other men outside of her marriage, and they didn't necessarily. None of them made her feel like a healthier human being.
Right.
And it's badly for her. So, I think there was a lot of transference on both sides, but most of it was of the best kind, I'd say.
Okay.
Where they idealized each other. Well, she especially idealized him, I'd say. Like, she said to him in one session, I'm at my best when I'm in here. How can I be like I am in here with other people? So that's one of the things that they worked on together.
Okay.
How could she do that?
Now, I'm going to get into some of the chapters of the book that you wrote here, which is An Accident of Hope, The Therapy Tapes of Anne Sexton. And what was Anne's relationship with John F. Kennedy? Where did that whole dynamic come into play?
She didn't have any relationship with him personally, but on the day that Kennedy died, she became very upset about his death, and she and her husband got into a huge fight because her husband, who she called Cale, was a Republican, and he thought that Kennedy was kind of a liberal who would steal everybody's money, and Cale was a And so he had voted for the Republican candidate, and she had voted for Kennedy. So when Kennedy died, she thought that Kay was blaming her for killing Kennedy, kind of like, you know, oh, now you've won. Your guy's going to become a hero. And at the same time, at the same day, for whatever reason, he revealed to her that he had killed someone with his bare hands, a prisoner of war, when he was in Korea. And so there was a lot of turmoil in the house that day. And
ended
up bringing it to Dr. Oren's attention and talking to him about how she thought Kao was a killer. And she and Kao often got into these drunken fights after dinner. And Kao several times tried to strangle her or put his hands around her neck. So there's a lot of violence between them, which she would often say that she felt like she sort of looked for, that she was kind of trying to get him, to goad him into being violent with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so they worked on this together. But the Kennedy thing was sort of like, it was almost like she saw her family as another kind of Kennedy family as well, that she and her husband were sort of like Jackie Kennedy and John F. Kennedy, that her husband was this handsome young guy and she was this beautiful, smart woman. And so I think she had a little bit of that too, that she saw herself that way. So it was a very complicated relationship in her mind and really productive in the sessions where they sort of sorted it out. And then she had a dream where she was in a car with her doctor, Dr. Oren, and it was sort of like a Kennedy dream. And she said to the doctor, well, it's all like the Kennedy thing, and she was trying to save his face in the dream. And so I talked about that quite a bit because he had made a couple of big mistakes in the treatment early on, and she was talking to him about this. And I thought in her dream she was trying to save his face, like, you know, help him not have to deal with it, you know, not be embarrassed by it. So I sort of interpreted this Kennedy thing in multiple directions. She also has a poem called The Assassination. It was about Kennedy's assassination.
And this was inspired by his assassination, of course.
Yeah.
In writing this, were you exploring the inner dynamics of the mind through mental health? Was this something that was really calling to you? Or what was the calling in regard to going through all this research for you?
Well, when I first got into the story of Anne Sexton, it was when I was a graduate student, and I was really intrigued by how someone could take the difficult, painful experiences of her childhood and make them into beautiful art. And I wanted to think more about that, and so that's one of the reasons that I chose Sexton. I was also deeply interested in her incest history, about whether I wanted to know whether it was true or not, and part of that was because there was father-daughter incest in my own family back a generation, so I wanted to kind of explore that more and think about it. And so that's how I started with Anne Sexton. I found her very endlessly interesting. Like, at first I thought all of her poems were the same, and then as I studied her more, I realized there was much more to them. And then I wanted to find out more about her herself, like who she was. So first I read Diane Middlebrook's biography, which is a beautiful book about Sexton. But that biography talked about these therapy tapes because the biographer had listened to these therapy tapes. And so I became fascinated with this idea that I wanted to listen to the therapy tapes. So I ended up doing that about 10 years later. It's pretty painful because some of the tapes are quite depressing, as you can imagine. People in therapy are often depressed. And yet I found them really evocative, and I kept going back for more and trying to figure out which days were better than others and why, and where there were moments of hope in the tapes, and how her poetry was related to these therapy sessions. And I have had my own history with therapy. I had maybe 12 years of psychoanalysis, actually, that were very helpful to me. It was a very nurturing therapist. And so I was really curious about that part of it, too, having been on the other side of the situation, having been the patient. I was interested in listening to a patient, talking to her doctor, because it gave me a chance to think about all the issues that come up in therapy from another point of view.
Right. In listening to the tapes, and I'm sure there was a gradual progression or awareness that you saw within her, but did you find that in listening to them, there was also a point of her actually processing as she was communicating? Because as we all know who've experienced therapy, there's a piece of us that really can't define what's going on until we hear ourselves say it out loud.
Did you find absolutely.
And did
well,
you find that with her? Did you, like her perception change as she was communicating? And
well, that's such an interesting question. You know, she started recording. The reason the tapes are recorded is that Dr. Owen found that she couldn't remember what happened from one session to the next. She had some pretty serious memory issues. So he decided to tape the session so that she could go back and listen to them before the next one and hear what had happened and sort of think about, you know, what she had said. So she started listening to the tapes right before her next session. So she'd sit in his office in a different room and transcribe the whole tape for the hour or so before her appointment. So she basically spent hours and hours studying her own therapy. She was a scholar of her own therapy sessions. And it's pretty fascinating to listen to her talk about what she hears that she didn't remember from the session. She'll say things like, oh my gosh, Dr. Oren, you were so right yesterday. What you were saying about what I was doing was exactly right, but I couldn't hear you. I was only hearing myself. So it's only when she would go back and kind of listen again that she would hear something different, you know, that she would hear him. And then she was able to process it more, in more detail. I think it's not quite that she would hear more. Well, I think it is what you're saying. She would hear what she was doing that she wasn't aware that she was doing. She would hear how she was trying to convince herself of something rather than just sort of telling the truth, if you know what I mean. Like so we,
right.
we all tell ourselves these stories about what's happening in our present lives. And some of the stories that we tell are very much based on what happened to us long ago. And she was able to recognize that a little bit better. Like she would say that Dr. Owen was being mean or difficult or obstinate, and then she would listen and find that he wasn't so difficult or obstinate after all when she would listen to the session on tape. And she would also recognize how she was what was the role that she was playing in her marriage in the arguments they were having.
Now, she got married actually very young.
Yeah,
and
she eloped when she was
18. And she eloped.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about, because that was, you know, at a time where, you know, that really wasn't as common as
right.
it is, of course, today.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the dynamics of her family, because her family, I can understand the lack of being demonstrative at that time frame in history, because
right.
as parents, there weren't many demonstrative parenting aspects
yeah,
at that time.
Right. Yes.
However, they were just mean. I mean, the things
yeah,
that
they
would accuse her of, I mean, it was horrendous, the things that I was reading here with,
yes.
with her father, and even her mother was a cold
yes.
fish. So, you know, let's talk about
cold.
The dynamics of her and Keo coming together and how that manifested.
Well, you know, she was a big flirt in high school. She had a lot of boyfriends, and it seemed like that was what she was, that was the role that she felt she was supposed to play. So she had a lot of boyfriends, and she had a lot of girlfriends, too, and a lot of socializing, and she had a car. And she became engaged when she was around 17 to some guy that she had met. And then she met Keo, and she broke off the other engagement, and she and Keo started dating, and then she thought she was pregnant. So she told her mother, I think I'm pregnant, and her mother said, well, I think you should elope. So she and Keo eloped, and while she was crossing the state line, they were going to Virginia to get married. While they were crossing the state line, she got her period, but they were so excited about what they were doing that they decided to get married anyway. And Keo was at the time at Colgate. He was a pre-med student at Colgate, and so she ended up going back with him to Colgate and living in the dorm basically with him and being a kind of sweetheart of his fraternity and cooking and learning to cook and, you know, playing the role of the wife. And that worked for a little while, but Keo started feeling guilty that his parents were supporting him and he wanted to have his own job. So he gave up on Colgate and pre-med scene and went to work for Anne's father. Probably the biggest mistake he ever made, because when he was working for Anne's father, who owned a wool business, he was very miserable. You know, he was traveling all the time. He was a traveling salesman, basically, and it was a really difficult role. And Anne was at home with these kids, and she wasn't very happy, and so he would feel torn between the family at home and taking care of them, dealing with his job, and it wasn't a great situation for him.
Okay.
Anne, on the other hand, went after they eloped, started taking modeling lessons, you know, going to modeling school, because she was very, you know, as you can see from the book cover, very stunning woman. And she did some modeling, but then eventually she got pregnant and moved away. And then from modeling, and then gradually, of course, she became a poet.
Wow.
And that's what she did. Her husband was not crazy about her being a poet. He just wanted her to be a nice little housewife. In fact, he told her psychiatrist, Dr. Oren, you should see what a wonderful hostess Anne is. And she brought this up. It's like it completely enraged her that he said this about her. She didn't want to be the hostess. You know, that wasn't her goal in life, to be a hostess. She really, you know, she wasn't crazy about that role of the 50s. It's sort of like, I mean, if you watch Mad Men, it's like Betty Draper in the house, these kids kind of stuck there, and what's she going to do, you know? That's how she felt about it, I think. She just wasn't who she was. It wasn't the life that she wanted.
Yeah, and it's actually...
But what was that going to be? Like, who was she going to be? That's the hard thing about the early 60s. There weren't a lot of places for women to thrive. I mean, luckily, she found poetry, and that did work for her. But still, it was not an easy transition. You know, it wasn't like she just popped onto the stage as a famous poet, and then she was saved, and everything was
great.
Right.
It's actually quite astounding that she was able to accomplish so much at that time frame as a woman in poetry with mental illness. I mean, that synopsis right there is just an incredible. It makes all of us take note in our own capacity of what we're capable of doing. So, you know, it makes us look at, okay, so we don't have mental health and we don't have these obstacles and it's not 1960. So, you know, there's less standing in our way. So, you know, kind of get the...
You know what happens? You know how it is when when you're very depressed, when you don't feel well, it's hard to imagine that you can do anything. And what happened with Sexton is once she got involved in writing a poem, she got really drawn into it. And she also had made a friend, Maxine Cuman, who was a poet. She met her in a poetry workshop in Boston at Harvard, at Radcliffe, the same one that I was talking about before. And she and Maxine became such good friends that they had another phone line installed in their houses, and they would call each other and read lines to each other in the morning. And they would also leave the phone off the hook, and when one of them wanted to read a line, they would whistle.
Oh, how fun.
So they basically had,
that?
Like, a writing workshop every day where they're, you know, they wrote all morning while their kids were at school. And then after school, sometimes the kids would play together. So Maxine was very, very helpful to Anne Sexton, and she was a good sort of ally and also a partner, a working partner, you know, like another poet that she could rely on. And that was important. So now, I mean, we know that one of the best things, one of the most helpful things when you're not feeling well, when you're mentally ill, when you're depressed, when you sometimes even when you're feeling suicidal, one of the best things is making contact with another human being. And sometimes it's the hardest thing, because it's the last thing that people want to do. They just want to hide in their, you know, in their beds, basically. You know, Anne Sexton's daughter, Linda, grew up to become a writer. She had two daughters, Linda and Joy. The older daughter, Linda, became a writer, and Linda has written a couple of books about her relationship with her mother. One of them, the first one was called Searching for Mercy Street, and the second one was called Half in Love, Recovering from a Legacy of Suicide. And that is about how she tried to kill herself, Linda, three times, actually. So she felt like she was following in her mother's footsteps. And the book is really about how she got out of that. How did she emerge from that story, her mom's story, and like become a person in the world with her own story and her own life. And it's very moving. But one of the most moving parts is how she recovered from one of her deepest depressions, which she called, you know, she's basically said she spent the year in bed. She found a wonderful therapist. She found a wonderful man who supported her. And she worked on making human contact and getting out of her bed. And she has this theory that as soon as you get out of bed in the morning, you have to make it, because otherwise you're going back into it. And she worked on, you know, day-to-day structuring of her life. And I think for people with mental illness, that's one of the hardest things. In my times of deepest depression, just getting through a day and figuring out how to make that day feel okay was very difficult, very difficult. And so I empathize with Anne Sexton and her daughter, and I also empathize with their use of writing as a way to make yourself, to heal yourself, that's part of the healing process.
It really is an incredible tool, and it's quite an awakening to see someone who used poetry, someone who never considered herself a writer, and using the poetry as a tool to pull herself out of the doldrums. And there's a piece here where she's actually talking about narcissism, which also was not a common awareness or a common discussion
right.
in regard to therapy. So let's talk
yes.
a little bit about her view on narcissism, how that came into
okay.
play here.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a poem of hers, and then can we talk about it that way?
Oh, certainly, certainly.
Okay, so I have this whole poem in my book on page 131, and it's called For John, Who Begs Me Not to Inquire Further. And it was her answer to her, one of her teachers who said her poetry was narcissistic and she should write about other things. So that's why I chose it. Not that it was beautiful, but that in the end, there was a certain sense of order there, something worth learning in that narrow diary of my mind, in the commonplaces of the asylum where the cracked mirror or my own selfish death outstared me. And if I tried to give you something else, something outside of myself, you would not know that the worst of anyone can be, finally, an accident of hope. I tapped my own head. It was a glass, an inverted bowl. It is a small thing to rage in your own bowl. At first it was private, then it was more than myself. It was you, or your house, or your kitchen. And if you turn away, because there is no lesson here, I will hold my awkward bowl with all its cracked stars shining like a complicated lie, and fasten a new skin around it, as if I were dressing an orange or a strange sun. Not that it was beautiful, but that I found some order there. There ought to be something special for someone in this kind of hope. This is something I would never find in a lovelier place, my dear, although your fear is anyone's fear, like an invisible veil between us all, and sometimes in private, my kitchen, my face, your face. So that's the poem, and basically I feel that in the poem she's saying, you think that I shouldn't be writing about my own life. You think that writing about my own head is narcissistic, that it's all about me. But you know what? It seems like a small thing to rage in your own bowl, to write about your own head. She says, I tapped my own head. But then as I looked at it, I realized it was more than myself I was writing about. It was you or your house or your kitchen. And at the end, she basically says, you know what? My kitchen is your kitchen. My face is your face. When I write about me, I write about you. Where I live is where you live. So I find this an incredibly beautiful response to the attack that she had been presented with. I don't know if it moves you as much as it moves me, but I just find
it
so
really
eloquent. Yeah, that she kind of turns it around and gives it back to him as a kind of gift. She takes his insult and makes it a kind of gift to him. And I really, I feel like that's what her poetry was about, that kind of transformation of poison and pain into something beautiful. And so in her sessions, interestingly enough, her therapist often accused her of narcissism. But he said that she was only concerned about feeling special, and that she wanted, as she often went to other therapists for consultations, and that she went to these other therapists in order to feel special with them, and she would give them her poetry books so that she could feel special. And Martin Oren would use this word special over and over again, like it was toxic, you know. And Sexton said eventually, you know, look, of course I want to feel special. Don't you want to feel special? You're a big researcher. You're running an institute. You know, you're off to run an institute next year. How is it that you don't want to feel special? Who doesn't want to feel special? And I really thought that that was so useful, that her criticism of him. And also he felt that she shouldn't want to feel that she shouldn't need so much affirmation that she was a poet. Like she was always saying, you know, I have made myself into a poet. That's a pretty good thing. And you would say, well, yeah, but it's important that you're that you are an individual, a human being. You're just as your own self, you're important. And he tried to separate the poetry from the person. And I talk about that throughout this book in a way. I just didn't think it was a good idea. I thought like that she would never try to separate him from being a doctor, for example. Like,
right.
Oh, you're a great person, even if you are a doctor. But I don't think he could have separated himself from the fact that he was a doctor. So it's just an interesting example of sexism that was alive and well in the early 60s, where he, you know, if she had been, say, I don't know, Robert Lowell, who was one of the most famous poets, confessional poets in Boston at the same time, I feel like he wouldn't have said the same. He wouldn't have attacked her the same way, that he wouldn't have said, oh, you're too invested in this idea of being a poet. I just think it was like this idea that women should be separate from the public sphere, that their space was the private space. And it's interesting in the poem that I just read where she makes the kitchen, the end of the poem, right? But her kitchen, she's bringing it to the public sphere. So she makes her kitchen into a career, basically.
Right,
so
right. She brings it right home to you.
And it's actually the word accident of hope is in this poem, but it's not an accident also that Julia Child was becoming famous in her kitchen right at the same time. And people were criticizing her, like, oh, why is this cook on television? Like, why would we want to do that? You know, that why would we want to celebrate cooking as if it were something important to pay attention to? And now look what it's become. All the food blogs and food shows. I mean, cooking is like 50% of the market or something right now, right?
Right. I mean, it's like,
so,
and there's always something new coming on into the market with food,
absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Yes.
It's interesting. And the other piece is look at how much psychoanalysis has become mainstream for America in regard to therapy. Now, I know that it was actually more accepted in Europe, as most alternative therapies do seem to be accepted there prior to here. How did the medical community embrace a Freudian concept in regard to psychoanalysis? Was it gradual? Was there a symposium on it? I mean, was there something that actually made America stand up and take note of Freudian psychoanalysis and use of perception?
Right post World War II, I think that's when there was the biggest influx of psychoanalytic thinking to the U.S. And I think it was this need for understanding the evil of human nature. You know, how is it that we just came through this like event in which millions of people were killed, like just for no reason at all? And what is that about? And then also this kind of terrible turmoil that people had as they came back from the war, like, well, who am I? What's my role in this world? And women had been in the workforce, and then they were forced back into the suburbs and into these kitchens where they were miserable. So there was a lot of unhappiness there. I think you might even remember on Mad Men, there's a psychoanalyst on that show who calls, he's Betty Draper's psychiatrist. Do you remember this? He calls Betty Draper's husband to report in on the therapy. So I think that there was a need for psychological understanding at that time like never before. So Freudian ideas became very popular. But my book is about how today the field has moved very far away from Freud, and the emphasis is much more on the relationship rather than on the doctor as the expert who's sort of finding the unconscious wishes and fantasies of the patient. So there's this idea in the early 1960s that someone like Martin Orne knew what the truth was, and he was going to tell it to Anne Sexton, like tell her who she was kind of thing. And now it's much more about the relationship that we play out in the relationship with our therapist, all of our other relationships that have caused us pain, and we try to figure it out this time. So we see our therapist, for example, as a tyrant, and then we say, well, how does this relate to my early childhood? Did I see my dad as a tyrant? It's like that we work more on in the here and now as a way to understand the there and then, so back there. In the early 60s, I think it was much more about looking back as the answer, like finding something that was shaping us from back there, but not investing in the present moment and how we structured our relationships in the present moment. Now, there's someone who wrote that therapy today, relational therapy, is very much about being in contact with a more expert relational partner. In other words, somebody who's better at relationships than you are, and you try to learn from them. Basically, like you learn to play tennis with someone who's much better at tennis than you. But it's not like you could never be a tennis pro. It's not that you could never be as expert at human relationships as your analyst, but you're working on it with someone who's pretty good at it. And back then, it was more of this smoke and mirror stuff where the doctor knew and the patient didn't, and the patient would never know the kinds of things that the doctor knew. Now, of course, there's residue from that period now, but I think there's been a breakdown in the Freudian model, which is in some ways constructed around this idea of the expert doctor who knows all. A little bit like the Dr. God, which is what Sexton calls her doctor in a few of her poems. She says, now, he's God of our block in the first poem, You, Dr. Martin.
And you know, her perception actually was really altered and shifted because of working with him and his models and his tools. But how is Freudian analysis different than Jungian analysis?
Oh, Jungian analysis is more about the collective unconscious, this idea that there are these basic myths and stories that we all live out. So if I were to come in and say, oh, I'm having trouble with my mother, I feel really angry at her, and I don't know what to do about it, then my analyst might say something like, well, you know, this reminds me of the story of Demeter and Persephone. And, you know, she might tell me a story, if you're Jungian, that's supposed to explain how I feel now. Does that make
sense? Okay. Yes,
so that's Jungian. So there are these myths and stories that explain ourselves to ourselves. And Freud is more about these conflicts that we have, that we don't know we have, that we're in these battles with ourselves that we need to have explained to us by someone on the outside. Like, why is it that at the same time that I want to be, that I love my husband, I want to be close to him, I also push him away? Why am I doing that? That's Freudian, that you would try to figure out. Oh, well, you know, this is related to my father. I felt that he loved me, but that he also loved my mother more. And so in order to deal with that fact, even though I yearned for him so intensely, I also pushed him away because I felt that he was pushing me away, you know, that sort of stuff. So that's more important.
Now, her tapes with her therapist were less than a year long. Is that correct?
Oh, no, they were 3 years.
Three years.
My book is only studying the last year.
Because it's too much to handle
all of it.
Oh, I imagine. I imagine it would be a lot to listen to. Did she continue therapy after 1965? Like, she died in 74, but did she?
Yeah, she did. Like I told you, her next therapist is this guy, Fred Duell, who was a therapist for like 5 more years, and he got into a sexual relationship with her. I think he was very entranced by the fact that she was a poet. And he wanted to be a poet himself. He would show her his poems. And he got all wrapped up in the romance of this therapy, and he left behind the patient. And so eventually his wife found out about it. And when she did, she forced him to end the therapy or end the marriage. And when he ended the therapy, that was sort of the beginning of the end for Anne Sexton, I think.
She became very established, even winning a Pulitzer Prize. That's something that quite notable, again, at that time frame for a woman. How did that, you know, was that something that she was able to kind of rest on her laurel a little bit with that, or was that even something taken from her where even the therapist was telling her, don't dwell on that. You're more than just a poet. You're a woman.
Won that prize, she was no longer with Martin Oren. She wasn't seeing him anymore. So that phase of her life was over. But I suspect that, I don't know because I don't have tapes about that time, right? So that's 1966. It's later. But what I suspect is that it was hard for her to hold on to that. That kind of success never really felt like something she could count on about herself. She was always worried about the next time she would be judged. You know, she was very fearful of being judged, as we all are. But I think for her it was acute. You know, that
it was
really
devastating.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it had to have gone back to these little tapes in her head from her father. I mean,
the horrible things, and the mother.
Yeah. And it didn't sound like they treated the other two daughters that way.
The thing is, I don't think that they treated them exactly the same way. But the fact is that the oldest daughter ended up killing herself a couple of years after Sexton killed herself. And the middle daughter, Blanche, in Linda's books, she writes about her being in a very abusive marriage with an alcoholic man who was violent. So I'm pretty sure that Blanche's life was not too pretty either. So for whatever reason, these girls did not end up having very high self-esteem and good feelings about themselves. Now, there was a lot of mental illness, I think, in the family background as well. There was suicide in the previous generations, several suicides. So there's probably a tendency towards depression or bipolar disorder that was inherited. But I think the family situation didn't make it much better. And alcohol, of course, doesn't make it any better.
Right.
Her parents both died quite young of alcohol-related illnesses.
And you actually find a tremendous amount of escapism through alcohol and drugs, sex and gambling,
yes,
when you have mental health and mental disease.
Yeah, that's true.
And
it's sad.
It's very sad because, you know, they're trying to stop the pain and they're trying to stop, you know, thinking, feeling, being what they are.
Right.
And the only time they get this reprieve is when they're numb.
Right.
And
they want,
you know,
more of it.
They want a lot more of it. And then the disconnect that creates in both your perceptual awareness as well as your, you know, in dealing with it. I mean, some of these things, even in the aspect where she started to dip her toe into the possibility that she was sexually abused by the grandmother and the father, there was also this piece of her, you know, unable to really process that. I mean, that was almost too much for her to delve into.
Yes. Yes,
because
absolutely.
Because the grandmother actually provided the only emotional comfort and support and demonstrative energy and love that she actually had in her years. Is that right?
Oh, her aunt. Is that who you're thinking of? Her mom's sister who ended up going crazy when she was 13. Her aunt Nana. So
okay.
Her aunt Nana lived
okay,
with a family.
Yes.
Yeah. So Nana lived with a family and she was very loving to Anne. And they had, used to have these cuddle sessions in her room. And they played games together and made up stories. And later, when Sexton was around 13, her aunt was taken off to an asylum because she lost her mind, basically. She became mentally ill. And Anne thought that she had become crazy at that same time that Anne had kissed a boy for the first time. So for her, these two things were related. But also there was a sense that maybe the aunt's cuddling with her had a kind of sexual overtone to it. So that maybe that was part of the incest stuff. Oh,
right.
It's just so complicated, you know.
Horrible,
but her main,
horrible.
You know, the main love that she got from her aunt was complicated. It was difficult to sort of, there are all these strands that were wound together. So she couldn't unwind the sort of sexual stuff from the love stuff. So it was very hard for her to look back on her childhood and find pure, unconditional, unselfish love.
Right, right. I mean, it's almost
yeah.
to the point where you have her really struggling within her own identity as a child. And, you know, you can actually see where the mental health, I mean, it may have been innate and inherent, but it's also triggered by so many different aspects of what she had to live through, by being the perfect daughter and having this image and having, you know, there was such emphasis put upon the most, you know, asinine aspects of life and living
right.
and family.
And
go ahead.
Well, just when she got older, when she ended up having the mental breakdown and she needed so much therapy, she wanted to go to college. And so she asked if her parents, who had money, would pay for her to go to college. And her mother said, and her doctor, Warren, gave her an IQ test. And he told her parents, you know, she has a very high IQ. And her mother said, well, I had the highest IQ ever recorded at Wellesley College. And where did it get me?
Oh, my God.
She was very narcissistic about it, I guess. So, you know, there's a session on page 189 where they're talking about this. And Orne said that Sexton's mother was so narcissistic, she had to be the star in the house. And that was a really big problem for Anne. And he said to Anne, you were actively trying to be dumb as a child. And she said, well, if I had such a big investment in being dumb, how did I let you convince me to do something so fast? If I hadn't really wanted to do a lot, how could I have allowed you to convince me? And Orne said, it wasn't that fast. Well, he gave the wrong answer, I think. He said it wasn't that fast. I think he should have said something like, well, obviously you had it in you all along. She said, well, in my first year of therapy, my first poem was at Christmas time, and I started seeing you in the summer. So basically she's like, look. He says, yeah, well, I saw you for 2 hours at a time. She laughs, and he laughs. Well, I didn't know it, Dr. Orne. It was wasted on me. I didn't know it was special. He says, it doesn't matter. The point is, I had to get important to you. Sexton says, you did get important. 2 hours is a long time. And Orne says, yeah. He says, yep. But I was the first person who you'd ever known who genuinely cared about you doing something and where you found that you wouldn't be rejected for it. Sexton said, but you had to make a very positive statement. And Orne says, yes, because when I pointed out that you had a high IQ, your mother pointed out to you that she had the highest IQ at Wellesley, and it didn't mean a goddamn thing. That statement by your mother typified your relationship like nothing else ever did. I can't think of a more harmful, destructive, more paralyzing thing she could have done, meaning it well. She thought she was supporting you. Sexton said, yes, she was pretty sure I'd score badly. Orin said, she was wrong. Sexton said, how confused you must have been as my poetry started to get better, and meanwhile she was dying. See how awful it is, that terrible parallel? And Orin says, I know. And Sexton says, still it was worth it to kill her. It's inevitable. Orin says, yes, you would have fantasies of that for sure. Talk about a twin relationship with Nana. You had one with your mother. Sexton said, like what? And Orin said, like dancing the jig. She had to be the dominant twin. So it's pretty powerful, that little exchange. And basically he's saying, you know, your mother was competing with you from the start. You were, you know, you had no chance. Like, what were you supposed to do, basically?
And, yeah, I mean, you're, you know, first of all, as a child, you are gaining and modeling yourself from your parents. And then to have dysfunctional parents and to have parents who are actually jealous of you. I mean, it's as if, you know, she didn't have a whole lot going for her in that period of time. What in regard to her own suicide, what came out of that? Did she leave suicide notes?
She locked herself in her garage and sat in the car and turned on the engine. So she basically died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Mm-hmm. And she had, you know, she left a very long kind of suicide note to her daughter that she had written before. She had written it well before this. She knew she would eventually kill herself. But I think that particular day, she just kind of, there wasn't any one thing that happened. It was just, you know, finally it worked. She had tried several times in her lifetime to kill herself, and this time it actually succeeded. Mm. So the one thing that's kind of interesting is that when she was found, that in her wallet was a review of her poetry that had been written in 1962. So this is 14 years later, and it was a very critical review of her poems. And she kept it. It was in her wallet her whole life. So it sort of shows the power of criticism, that she, it was hard for her to shake it off. That she couldn't, you know, she just, yeah. And it was like, it was such a, I don't know, it's just one of those terrible examples of one poet destroying another, basically a male poet destroying a female poet. And not, I don't know, you know, if he realized that that would be so hurtful to her, but she took it, you know, it's hard to take criticism, but this particular kind of criticism was just very painful, you know, and,
right.
And she, you know how we have those voices in our heads, right? And she did, like everybody
right.
does, and she, it was hard for her to let them go.
And
it was hard for her also to take in the good. And I think that's what therapy is about, you know, it makes you increasingly, it's like a tidal wave eventually, like there's all this good feeling coming towards you. So eventually you don't have any choice but to accept that it's real.
Right.
And I think she was just beginning to feel that when things went awry for her.
Do you feel
you
that
know,
she ever...
Boston.
Do you ever feel like she ever truly discovered her true essence of who she was? You have your final chapter. It's called The Discovery of a Human Being. Let's talk a little bit about what her final assessment of who she was became.
Well, you know, Dr. Orin was moving. He was going to Philadelphia, so he was basically leaving her, and this was very difficult for her because she felt abandoned, of course, and, you know, it sort of dovetailed with her earliest abandonment, and she was in a lot of pain. But she said to Dr. Orin, you know, like, what we created together, we can't, you know, that's something. So she says, I told my friend Anne that I just started to grow in therapy. I'm now about 7 years old, because they've been in therapy together for 7 years. My friends got this idea that psychiatry isn't creative. But I said, I'm 7 years old. You could call that the discovery of a human being. How's that for a creative process? Because surely this is a creative process. There's a great element of trust in our relationship and me recognizing my needs. Orin said, that's the most important part. And Sexton said, well, you know, if you get something back and you've got something to give, it's really rather delightful. And Orin said, that's the most remarkable part. And Sexton said, so that's what I mean about the discovery of the human being, or whatever you want to call it, and that's a pretty creative process. I just thought that was so beautiful, you know, that she was really emphatic about it. She said it three times, that what they were engaged in together was a very creative process. So I think that her poetry was in certain ways like mimicking what they were doing in the sessions, but not mimicking, but sort of another way of expressing that kind of dialogue. And, you know, people become more themselves through their interactions with others. It's not like the Freudian theory would suggest that we go deep inside and there we find like there's a little dawn waiting there for me if I keep digging deep enough. But the truth is that the dawn who is talking to you today, I have become who I am through my conversations with people like you and people like my therapist and my husband, people who I really feel respected by and I can feel listened to by. And then that listening process makes me feel more powerful in my own self. It's not narcissism. It's more about feeling the ground under your feet. You feel safe to breathe and live like, oh, yes, I have the right as a human being to do this, to be this person. And, you know, it's such a tragic thing that I would say most people don't feel that way. They don't feel that they have the right to be themselves.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean?
That's wonderful. Yeah, it really is, because it empowers the soul and it takes energy away from the disease and gives power back to the person. And there's
yeah.
such an incredible awareness in reading this book, and I really thank you for putting so much research and effort into, you know, using psychoanalysis for the mental health community, because there's, especially with the economy the way it is, there's so much
yeah.
more of it, and there's
That's
so
right.
much more being triggered. So, you know,
yeah.
it gives people hope that you can move through this. And unfortunately, Anne, you know, did not move through hers. But the
right.
insight into it definitely has been assisted through therapists and therapies and
definitely.
The work.
Yeah.
So thank you, Dawn, for doing all of
thank
this.
You. Thank you.
Thank you so
Lisa,
much
really
for being
talking
on.
To you.
This was a great, great insight, and thanks for being on Unlimited Realities. And where can people get more of your wisdom and insight?
Well, if you look up my name or the book An Accident of Hope online, then there'll be more information and some more interviews that I've done, and you can buy a copy of the book there, and also there's some articles that you can pull up for free.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being my guest today. And
thank you, Lisa.
I look forward to discussing this. I'm sure I'm going to have some emails coming in from this, and I will direct them your way.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
And
take care.
You're welcome. The book, bye-bye. Again, is The Accident of Hope, The Therapy Tapes of Anne Sexton, Dawn Scorsese. Thank you so much, Dawn.
Bye-bye.
God bless. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Bye-bye.